From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 4 more years, just before noon, George W. Bush took the oath of office.
I, George Walker Bush,
do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute
the office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
The Bush the nation saw today was ramrod straight and determined as he asked the country to lead the fight, the world, in a fight against tyranny. 4 years ago, it was an untested George Bush who placed his hand on the Bible. Today, same man, but different experience, a different time, a different outlook on the world. Tonight, On Point, the evolving George Walker Bush at the beginning of his second term. But first tonight, a taste of the festivities going on in D.C. Republicans in the nation's capital are pouring the bubbly and putting on the glitz at parties around Washington. Partygoers have anteed up big bucks for the 9 official balls. Price of admission starts at nearly $800. Robin Abkarian is national features editor for the Los Angeles Times. She joins me now from the Democracy Ball. Hi, Robin. What's going on there?
Hi, Tom. Well, it's filling up rapidly. They're actually a little bit worried that the ball is oversubscribed, even though it's in an absolutely huge, cavernous room.
You're in the convention center. Price of admission, $795. Describe the crowd for us. Who's there? What kind of people?
Well, it's a lot of, as you can imagine, very enthusiastic Bush supporters, people who are very well heeled for the most part, I would say. Although I have bumped into a few students, some law students and so forth, but there's lobbyists and lawyers and, because this is the California ball, there's some entertainers from California who are here. We do expect at some point Governor Schwarzenegger to make an appearance. But for protocol reasons, I'm sure he'll be on long before the vice president and the president get here. That is, of course, the most highly anticipated moment. And it's funny because when I first walked into the ballroom, there were a lot of people clumped around a stage at the very, very far end of the room. And it turned out that they were getting themselves into position for handshakes and photos with the president.
So lining up early. Robin,
yeah.
There's a lot of talk about the money spent on the inauguration. Of course, they're never cheap, but this may be the most expensive. And about how glitzy. But then in the event, these are big events that happen in convention centers. Does this feel like a glitzy night to you or something not? Rubber chicken.
It's so funny that you say that because, as a matter of fact, when I first walked in, I thought, this is it. This is the glitzy ball. But I have to tell you, as more and more people filtered in, the men in tuxedos and the women in their nice gowns, it does start to feel a little more elegant. However, unfortunately for a lot of the people, the fire marshals have determined that too many chairs in the room would be a fire hazard if people needed to leave suddenly. So you've got people perched all over the floor, which detracts somewhat from the elegance. But mostly people are saying, we don't care. We're just really happy to be here.
I'm sure they are sitting cross-legged in their ball gowns. And Robin, what about the protesters? I know there are a lot in Washington today, but they must be far from the kind of venue you're in. Is there any intermingling of these two crowds of supporters and protesters?
I really haven't seen, on my approach to the convention center, I walked probably 2 blocks before I got in the door. There was absolutely no sign of any protesters. I had seen them when I left the swearing-in earlier this morning all over the place, even asking me for directions because they were from out of town, some of them. But no, here tonight, absolutely none of that. It's a completely unified kind of front. I don't know if the demonstration sort of petered out on their own or people feel that they made their point, but it seems at this point anyway in the evening to be pretty demonstration free. The other thing is, you know, the security is intense and there are gauntlets of barriers and police officers to get through and metal detectors before you even get into the convention center.
Well, Robin, I guess you've got the Schwarzenegger coming on and later the president. I've seen the First Lady tonight dancing away in her kind of a glittering rhinestone gown, lots of bare shoulders and fancy gowns all around.
Yes.
Enjoy your evening there, Robin.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us.
It was a pleasure.
Robin Abkarian, national features editor for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me from Washington. So it's take two tonight. The second Bush term is now officially underway. It follows a tumultuous first term, a contested election, 9/11, war in Afghanistan, invasion of Iraq, trouble in Iraq, strained relations with much of the world. 4 years ago, George W. Bush was straight in from Texas, little traveled and little tested. His past was checkered, his demeanor was simple, straightforward. Then came a world of problems. Tonight on Point, the evolution and education of George W. Bush. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you read the character, the evolving worldview of the man, again, in the White House? Beyond a few more gray hairs, what changes do you see in George W. Bush? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is David Ignatius, columnist for The Washington Post. David, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
You've been writing about the president and the kind of path he's been on, the kind of changes that you've seen in the president that he's demonstrating to the world. What do you see?
Well, the first thing that struck me today was just how different he looked physically from 4 years ago. My recollection of 4 years ago, refreshed by the television reruns that we see, are of a man who seemed nervous when he was sworn in 2001. His eyes darted back and forth. He seemed to fidget a bit. He said at one point to an interviewer he was afraid that he might start crying when he saw his father up there with him. I wrote in the Washington Post that he had this odd sense that his suit seemed a half a size too big for him. No one would say that about the person that we saw today.
Certainly not.
He looked confident. He looked extremely healthy and vigorous. You know, he's not much better at giving a set speech than he was 4 years ago.
Though he seemed pretty good today. I don't know how you heard it, but he seemed to belt it straight out there.
Well, I thought it was an extremely well-written speech. I'd love to talk about the speech in a minute. I just think in terms of his delivery, he will always be a man who gives a sort of flat speech, and that was the one thing I thought hadn't changed all that much. But I thought it was a fine speech. It seemed to me that this man really has grown into his role as a president. He's, you know, every son measures himself against his father, and he's done the thing his father couldn't do. He's gotten reelected. Here he is. And you just felt the confidence that's inside the man now.
So evolution, first of all, simply in terms of feeling at home in his skin as president. I mean, you can't expect someone at their first inauguration to have that, but he certainly has gone through the fire in this first term.
He's been tested. He's gone through the fire. You know, what's striking is that he doesn't look to me, aside from the gray hairs, like a man who's really been battered by the experience of being president. You looked at Lyndon Johnson after his term in office. He really looked like a beaten man. You know, you could say the same about other presidents. You don't have that feeling about Bush. To me, what was striking about the speech was the intense idealism of it. I mean, this is as idealistic a president as we've had, at least about foreign policy, since Woodrow Wilson, I would argue. The second thing that struck me was the disconnect between the idealism of the speech, which it's hard not to admire, and what's happening in the world. I mean, you know, it's been noted widely today that he didn't mention Iraq once in the speech.
Mm-hmm.
But more to the point, the speech was not informed by the reality of what's happening in Iraq. He was setting an agenda for the United States of global transformation, which would be difficult to do even in the happiest of times when we were on a roll. But in a period when we're suffering very serious reversals in a war in Iraq, when we have 150,000 troops pinned down, when we're deeply unpopular just about everywhere, the agenda that he set is extremely unrealistic, and the president didn't seem to have any sense of that at all.
David, I'd like to go straight at that with you, and to the extent that you can, share with us where that comes from. Is this the president's famous religiosity speaking? I mean, religion in part is the ability to look at a kind of higher plane and believe in a higher plane, even when you're beset by problems. Or is this, I don't know, the man who's been through transformations himself before, when he gave up drinking, after that had become a problem for him, through setting higher goals, through believing in a higher power? Or is it the people he's surrounded by? To what do you attribute the president's power? He knows what's going on in Iraq. He knows how the world is looking at the U.S., presumably. And yet he can look at that far horizon. What is it in his character that fuels or that powers that?
Well, you've asked, you know, the interesting question about the man, and it'll take us many years to fully understand that, But I think it's pieces of all the things you described. I mean, first, his religious belief does give him an anchor. It gives him a way to hold fast in very difficult times, which are what these are. Second, you know, I think that he truly believes what he said. There's a universalism in the speech that is a kind of strategy. I think it's an unrealistic strategy, but I don't mean to discount it. He's saying we cannot be secure, our liberty cannot be secured until the world's liberty is secured. You know, an unfree, unstable world is going to come back at us in the way that we saw on September 11th. So he's setting this extraordinary course of really liberating everybody before we'll feel secure at home. I also think that this White House, this administration, is to a disturbing extent a closed circle. I don't think that they're listening carefully to what they're hearing from professional military officers, from professional intelligence officers. I mean, I'm quite certain from the people that I talk to that the professionals are telling the president things are not going well. We are in some difficulty. And I just don't think that message is getting through. I don't think you were hearing a president who understands we're in some trouble now. We really have to hunker down and get through this and out of it. Instead, it's this transformational agenda as if everything's going great.
I couldn't help wondering what thoughts were going through his father's mind today as the camera would pan to George H.W. Bush, his son, talking a super idealistic message here. Here's a former president, former head of the CIA, a much more pragmatic guy, prudent, the word he liked to use.
Yeah.
I couldn't help wondering what he thought of the character of his son, the sort of wellspring of his son's confidence to reach for these stars.
You know, I think any father would look at this son and you know, with a sense of wonder and pride. His son has outdistanced anything this father could have imagined for him. George Bush Sr. was a careful man. I mean, his signature line, wouldn't be prudent, mm-hmm. really captured that caution. His whole generation that had come through the Cold War was that way. They'd all grown up with the nightmare that the world might suddenly fall into nuclear war, you know, an existential crisis that could destroy life on the planet. That was what they went to bed with every night. And so it gave them a kind of abiding caution. That is not present in the son. And I think the father, if we read the comments of his closest advisors, people like Brent Scowcroft, who was his national security advisor, that generation looks at this very idealistic son, George W. Bush, with some increasing concern. Scowcroft has been outspoken in the last month saying, you know, we are really heading into a storm in Iraq. Let's look honestly at what's going on. But I don't think it's getting through.
David, you say that this president, George W. Bush, resists the tragic sensibility that other presidents conveyed at moments when they were in difficult wars. Why? How do you interpret that? What do you mean?
Well, you know, I think as I look back at histories of inaugurations this past week, as many of us did, I was struck by how many times presidents have stood on the edge of great difficulty abroad because of war. Woodrow Wilson, in his second inauguration in 1917, knew that the United States would be dragged soon into World War I. It was something he dreaded, and he had deep fears that the American system, the Constitution itself, might not be able to survive the crisis that was coming. If you read the material that's available now about Lyndon Johnson in late 64 and 65 as he was being inaugurated to his own term, he was a man who was absolutely vexed by the question of Vietnam. He knew in 1965 that this was not going to turn out well. He said to his Secretary of Defense McNamara, there's going to be nothing as bad as losing this, but I don't see any way to win it. So there was this tragic sense with leaders like that. Even the father, George H.W. Bush, I think looked at war, perhaps because he'd been through World War II, with this sort of tragic sensibility.
We've just got 20 seconds, but not so with this president.
Well, this president doesn't seem to have it. What I wrote this week is he may not have the sort of brooding, complex, introspective character that leads to that tragic sensibility, but he may need it given what's ahead.
Well, in place today, a very high idealism. David Ignatius, columnist with the Washington Post, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
We're talking about the evolving George W. Bush, Bush the man at the start of a second term. You can join us. How do you read the character, the evolving worldview of the man in the White House? Again, we're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the evolving George W. Bush. You can join the conversation tonight. Beyond a few more gray hairs, what changes do you see in this president? Did you imagine that the man who spoke of a more humble America 4 years ago would ever, could ever give the kind of speech he gave today? What have you come to understand as the driving motivation of George W. Bush? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. President Bush, on the steps of the Capitol building today, expressed his utter, complete confidence in the goals that he laid out.
We go forward with complete confidence in the eventual triumph of freedom. Not because history runs on the wheels of inevitability. It is human choices that move events. Not because we consider ourselves a chosen nation. God moves and chooses as he wills. We have confidence because freedom is the permanent hope of mankind, the hunger in dark places, the longing of the soul.
President Bush today expressing complete confidence. We're joined right now from Austin, Texas, the president's old stomping grounds, by Wayne Slater, senior political reporter for the Dallas Morning News, co-author of Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. Wayne Slater, thanks for being with us tonight.
Tom, it's great to be with you.
So you've been watching this president for a long time, even quite a while now since you came out with the book. In your view, has President Bush grown past Karl Rove?
I mean, it's extraordinary. I'm not sure he's grown past Karl Rove, but certainly he would say that, and Karl tells me that routinely. But the thing that always strikes me, and has, it seems, day after day, week after week, I saw it. I was in the inaugural crowd on 4 years ago, and as I would watch the post 9/11 George Bush deal with that catastrophe, mm-hmm. as I watched the development of the war, and then as I saw this speech today, at every point, I have to stop and say, I am amazed that this is the same person who I began covering 12 years ago.
And why? Why amazed?
The guy, now there's some similarities. In many ways, he is the same person, obviously. He was disciplined then, always has been, direct, likes the idea that he is understated. He's terrifically on time. That's one thing that's not changed. But the George Bush who ran for governor in Texas beginning in 1993 and ran in 1994 and beat Ann Richards was largely tentative, reserved. Mm-hmm. He was not confident at all about state government. At one point, as he was a candidate, Karl Rove and others had to set up specific classes for him, the son of a president, a guy who had been around politics all his life, or much of his life, in one form or another, mm-hmm. because he didn't know very much, really, about state politics.
And this just about Texas, let alone the entire nation world.
Absolutely. Now, they did the same thing in 1999 as he prepared for the White House.
Let me ask you then, Wayne Slater, if I may, because today the president is not only astride the world, but he's describing in this speech very, very bold vision for the world. We've heard in conversations tonight perhaps one of the most idealistic speeches ever given by an American president. How do you interpret that? Where does the confidence of that kind of bold vision, agree or disagree with it, support it or run from it, where does it come from?
Yeah, again, I think I have to demur a little bit, just as David did, but I'll venture a couple of thoughts. One is that he has grown extraordinarily confident over the years in his ability to do the job that he's doing, first as governor, then as reelected as governor and as president and so forth. Even in these difficult situations, he has greater confidence now in his actual ability, the sort of tools of the job, surround yourself with a small group of people, be focused, develop some ideas about a few things, know where you're going, and delegate. And all those are cliches, but that really is the way to the opera. That's one.
So he's been around the track, and he's also felt how positively the country's responded to
him. But there's more than that. Mm-hmm. And this is something that David had alluded to. And this whole business of tragic sensibility, his inability to sort of look at the war in a way that perhaps some others have. I've talked to George Bush for years about religion. And this was before he would talk publicly. It wasn't really that he talked publicly about religion in a political context until about early months of 1999, really. Mm-hmm. But as governor, we would talk, privately about it. And this faith is real with him. Now, what it means is a matter of somebody's definition. But it is real. In George Bush's universe, he is an evangelical. And in his universe, he believes that we are engaged in a divine drama. That there is a battle between good and evil. Now, he's not some crazy. He's not some nut, television, evangelist mm-hmm. or so forth. But he believes in he's a Methodist, my gosh. And here in Texas, those are considered
moderates.
Yes. Right. But at the same time, he believes that there is a divine reason, a divine drama being played out on earth, and that good and evil are battling as a very tangible forces, and that he is involved in that exercise.
And who do you think has linked that sense, born in his evangelical religion, of a divine drama playing out, who has linked that to the details of foreign policy or to a foreign policy agenda? Is that George Bush himself, or is there an inner circle, a brain trust that has said to him, President Bush, we understand your faith, look out here, here's the material waiting for it to address?
I think it's both. I mean, I think he does see in his religious faith the idea of good and evil. He's inclined, always has been inclined, to fairly quickly and simply, some people say simplistically, I don't think it's simplistic, but fairly simply define the enemy, the adversary, the other, in fairly black and white terms. So I think he sees in this terrorism, the battle against terrorists, kind of black and white religious theological aspect that he's able to do it. But that's reinforced with the Wolfowitzes, Richard Pearl back when he was certainly was advising the president, and others inside the neocons, essentially, who reinforced the idea of an aggressive foreign policy, taking what is something that's foreign policy but has a kind of theological religious dimension. I mean, remember, when the president talks about spreading freedom, he always links two things, not always, but you hear him if you're listening to yeah. different speeches. One, I want to spread this idea of freedom. Obviously, that was the theme today mm-hmm. to the world. Mm-hmm. But then what does he say? He didn't say it today precisely, but in other speeches, freedom is not our gift to these countries. Freedom is God's gift to the world. And so as he thinks in his mind, reinforced by the idea of this is the military or this is the foreign policy approach to achieve this goal, in his mind, this expression of freedom and now this rather aggressive idea of taking it to other nations is not simply a matter of what 200-year-old concept of democracy is developed by the founding fathers and expressed in our Constitution, but it is something bigger. It is part of a divine mission.
Doesn't that go back to the Declaration of Independence? Isn't that kind of where he's rooting that view?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think he's very. And what that does is gives him some confidence in where he is.
I want to welcome to our conversation now from New York, Midge Dechter, essayist, social critic, author of Rumsfeld, A Personal Portrait. She's a member of the Heritage Institute, a 2003 recipient of the National Humanities Award, wife of Norman Podhoretz, sort of godfather of the neoconservatives. Midge Dechter, wonderful to have you tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Wonderful to be here. I was fascinated by the speaker I was listening to.
That's Wayne Slater with the Dallas Morning News and a longtime observer of the president. Uh-huh. I'm sure you were watching very, very closely today. Were you?
Oh, yes.
Were you? You must have been hopping up and down with celebration. This was about as powerful a neoconservative view of the world expressed by the president today as one could imagine.
Yeah, well, I think it's something like, I'm never sure what people mean when they say neoconservatives, because most people mean it in a hostile way. So let us say that it is a vision that was behind the policy of this country for 40 years when we were holding off. At least it was for a lot of people in this country.
In the Cold War, you're saying?
In the Cold War, holding mm-hmm. off Soviet power. with the idea that maybe one day we might see the breakdown of the Soviet Union, which we did, at least of the Soviet Empire, which we lived to do. I never believed we would. It's not really a new idea, but what is new is the simple, direct, uncomplicated way this man articulates that.
And you see that as a tremendous advantage, as I hear you.
I see it as something, a terrific reminder, particularly that remark that you quoted before, when he said, we are not giving freedom to others. Freedom, it's God who has decreed that all men should be free. I'm sure God didn't mean that in a political sense, but it's something very, very simple. There is no reason for lucky people living in the United States of America to imagine that others, it's okay with other people to get kicked around, put it that simply.
We're trying to get a sense of the evolving worldview, character of this president tonight. What do you think it is, Midge Dector, that has made George W. Bush such an effective vessel for this view of the world?
Well, I don't pretend to know, and I certainly don't know him personally. And I've only seen him and paid attention to him as president, not even as governor. But it's clear that he has an enormous clarity of mind. He has principles, and he's got them very clear in mind. Nothing fancy. Nothing overcomplicated and hypercomplicated.
Is that a good thing?
It is certainly a good thing.
Wayne Slater, do you agree? Nothing fancy, nothing complicated.
I don't mean that he's simple-minded.
No, I
mean,
I understand.
There's nothing complicated about this feeling of American mission.
Wayne Slater, do you agree? The sense of clarity, of kind of simple embrace. Not, Ms. Dector says, not simplistic, but simple and therefore strong.
Absolutely, I agree. She's got it exactly right. And now, of course, I am speaking to you from the heart of Texas, a red state and a red region where people like it simple. And again, not simplistic, but like it direct and simple. That has always been a political attribute that I think has served him well. But beyond it being a political attribute, he really had the ability as governor. I think he continues to have that as president, though the difference in those jobs is extraordinary, obviously. But he had the ability to look at long, detailed, complex ideas. And in a state, it could be school finance, it could be tax issues, it could be other matters. But to distill those fairly quickly. Now, at the same time, to be fair, he had aides, loyal aides, who he demanded that they distill these things fairly succinctly, present them to him, because he has a pretty short attention span, but then he would make decisions. And they were gut decisions that very often were, again, to use what Midge said, were simple. Or as we would say in Texas, this is just common sense. You look at a situation, you evaluate it, and you decide by your gut.
A phrase that the president used today, so there's that powerful simplicity or clarity, as Midge Dector described it, yet we heard David Ignatius saying earlier he feels or fears a kind of resistance to taking on board some of the realities or consequences that surround that. I want to hear from our callers. Ed is calling from Smithville, Rhode Island. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
How are you?
Very well, thanks, Ed. What do you think?
I think that the George Bush speech today can be easily equated with Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, except that Martin Luther King was a man of peace. George Bush is a man who believes in violence. The speech should have been spoken maybe by a minister, by someone who is not in authority to punish other nations, to strike other nations at his own will, at his own choosing. And whoever wrote the speech did an excellent job, but it should not have been read by George Bush today.
Ed, we've got it, and let us pick it up. Midge Dector, I think You know, there's this different ways things are received.
I think to refer to the fact that we are at war,
yes,
with terrorists in the Middle East, and to say that he is a man of violence is oversimplistic, to put it oversimplistically.
Yeah, well, let's put it slightly differently then. Some people will listen today.
A man of violence. He's not a man of violence.
Let's put it differently, if I may. Some people will hear the president today and say that is a clarity and a glorious description of what's going on. Others will hear what he described in almost apocalyptic terms, that he's dividing the world, that he's sort of setting up a clash, a crusade kind of clash. Do you understand that fear?
Yes, I do. Look, probably the greatest man who ever sat in the White House was a man named Abraham Lincoln.
Mm.
He was, in the end, responsible for the slaughter of, I cannot remember the number, but it's some unthinkable number of his fellow citizens who were slaughtering one another.
Mm-hmm.
Because he had one simple idea, if you want to call it simplistic, and that was that this union of states must hold together. And anything was worth that. Now, here we sit in the luxury of this wonderful country, and we are the beneficiaries of that absolute certainty on Lincoln's part, which led to horrible bloodshed. That is true. And also to free the slaves. Okay.
Are you suggesting by that we should prepare for that kind of bloodshed again? Does it come with the audacity?
No. Look, there's been hardly any bloodshed in Iraq.
Well, I don't know about that.
By comparison with what? The people who are opposed to Bush and don't like him, of course, will say that it's absolutely unacceptable. But the fact is that the United States was at war in World War II, in Europe, not on our shores, against a force called Nazism, and also in the Pacific against people who had attacked us. The slaughter was unthinkable. I mean, just imagine, tell me how many people were killed on the beach on D-Day.
Well, certainly many times what's been lost in Iraq, and yet George Bush's own father agonized over each death in a way that George W. Bush seems not to.
How do we know whether he agonizes or not?
Well, we can read from his own diary entries.
A man cannot conduct a war, a country cannot conduct a war, without there being loss of life. That's what wars are about. But sometimes you settle for a certain amount of loss of life in order to avoid a far greater one.
And here's a president who's very capable of seeing the world in just those terms. Midge Dechter, I know we have to let you go, but thank you so much for being with us tonight.
It was my pleasure.
Midge Dechter, author of Rumsfeld, The Personal Portrait. Wayne Slater, stick with us. We're talking about the evolving George W. Bush, Bush the man at the start of his second term. And listeners, we'd really like to hear from you as well. What have you come to understand as the driving motivation of George W. Bush? He transformed his own life to get off the booze. Is he now looking to transform the world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight on Inauguration Day about the evolving George W. Bush. You can join us tonight. Is George Bush's personal embrace of global transformation today appealing to you? Is it inspiring? Is it frightening? And what do you think drives the man in the White House now? At the conclusion of George Bush's speech today, he's talking about great achievements and stepping up to them.
When the Declaration of Independence was first read in public and the Liberty Bell was sounded in celebration, a witness said it rang as if it meant something. In our time, it means something still. America in this young century proclaims liberty throughout all the world and to all the inhabitants thereof. Renewed in our strength, tested but not weary, we are ready for the greatest achievements in the history of freedom.
President Bush at midday today on the Capitol steps, a protester's voice in the background, but front and center, the president with a hugely idealistic message today, quite a range of receptions. We want to keep track of what's going on in Washington tonight as we're talking. Of course, balls and parties all over town. We're joined right now from the Texas-Wyoming Ball by Jeff Zeleny with the Chicago Tribune, who's just been at the Texas-Wyoming Ball where President Bush is. He's national political correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. Jeff, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening.
The president just spoke at that ball. Did you hear what he had to say?
I did. He made only very brief remarks. I think he's probably feels like he's talked out at this point in the day, even though his inaugural address was, you know, about 20 minutes or so. But he repeated a few themes of his address. He said he really wants to bring freedom and liberty, two words we heard a good deal of today. He wants to, you know, that to be part of his legacy. And then he ended his very brief remarks with a look to his first lady, and he said, will you dance? So they danced a few bars of music, and they went off to their next event. So really not much substance here tonight, just a lot of happy, happy Republicans just eager to host the beginning of a second term.
The Texas-Wyoming Ball, the home states of the president and the vice president. Of course, the black tie and boots ball last night. Did it have a Western feel at this one, Jeff?
It has a bit of a Western feel, but not quite as much as last night. It's only a few cowboy hats here that I saw and not any cowboy boots that I saw. Not checking everyone, of course, there were probably 12,000 people there or so. But it had a Texas flair, and certainly a lot of the president's friends were in the audience.
And are you cordoned off from the crowd? We heard earlier reporters saying that they couldn't actually mingle with the attendees. Were you in the same situation, Jeff?
Well, it depends how crafty you are with these things. You know, the presidential inaugural committee would very much like you to be cordoned off into a pen, but I've been to a couple of the balls tonight, and I have talked with several party activists and several people who worked on the campaign. So I've been able to move around quite a bit.
What's the tone? What's the culture, the ambiance that you're feeling?
Well, some people, frankly, are a little bit disappointed. They think they are paying, you know, money to come to sort of an intimate gathering. Well, you know, the reality is there are most of the balls are in separate small rooms of the giant Washington Convention Center. So there's not much ambiance, quite frankly. I mean, there's limited food. You have to pay for your drink, $6 for a glass of champagne. I heard one woman grumbling. She thought that would be complimentary. So it's not, you know, the Ritz is certainly, but that's not why they're here. They're very happy to see the president and to host him. But a couple party activists, just rank and file people I talked to, said this is their first ball, and they were expecting a little bit more.
At $995 a pop for the ticket, so they might have expected a free drink. But anyway, they got their president. Jeff Zeleny, thanks very much for being with us.
Have a good evening.
We're talking about the president's character today. He's speaking very boldly. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We've been joined from Austin, Texas, the president's old stomping grounds, by Wayne Slater, senior political reporter for the Dallas Morning News and co-author of Bush's Brain. We're joined right now from Arlington, Virginia, by James Pinkerton, columnist for Newsday, former aide to Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, a regular contributor to the Fox News Channel and a fellow at the New America Foundation. James Pinkerton, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You heard the president's speech this morning, no doubt extremely bold. I was watching the faces of Republicans in the audience, and I saw some thrilling to it, and others I wasn't quite sure what they were thinking. You've got experience in Republican administrations. What did you think of the very high tone, high idealism, in Bush's terms, of the speech today?
Well, I thought it was absolutely Kennedy-esque, and I mean John Kennedy back in 1961. Don't let memories of Teddy Kennedy or Bobby Kennedy get in the way of the extremely ambitious, hawkish, global speech that John Kennedy gave when he said in 1961, the same revolutionary beliefs for which our forebears fought are still at issue around the globe, the belief that the rights of man come not from the generosity of the state but from the hand of God. To me, that's the tone that Bush struck today. It's what Kennedy struck 44 years ago. And I guess if I were advising Republicans, I would say, now just think a little bit where that all led in terms of both high ambitions and also to a fair amount of difficulty in Cuba, in Europe with the Soviets, and then, of course, in Vietnam.
So, on balance, were you inspired or frightened?
I was taken aback. I guess I'd have to say that I was taken aback. I mean, it was pretty clear from the campaign that Bush would, you know, be emphasizing the March of Freedom and the Bush Doctrine and so on and so on. But the last few months, most of the discussion here in town, in Washington, that is, has been about Social Security and privatized accounts and stuff that is pretty humdrum compared to ending tyranny around the world. I mean, humanity's been looking for 5,000 years to end tyranny and hasn't succeeded yet.
We've heard from Wayne Slater and others tonight. How do you interpret James Pinkerton? What it is in this president's heart, in his religious beliefs, in his background, in his inner circle, that leads him to embrace that kind of hyper high vision of what might be achieved?
I think it's clearly. I mean, this, if you had a concordance to the Bible with this speech in front of you, I think you'd find just about every other line is some little bit of code. Some biblical reference. I've got a friend of mine who's working on a piece on just this now, and I think it'll be proved very rich. I mean, I've never heard a president invoke the Quran before as a source of inspiration on the application of religion and freedom around.
And that's something you won't find in the Bible, but he must have felt he had to.
Well, I mean, what unites Christianity and Islam both is a sense of destiny, a sense of evangelism, a sense of transformation, a sense of a better world. Oftentimes, as history shows, a better world in the view of Christians and Muslims achieved by the sword.
Islam has famously produced a lot of jihadis in recent years. Is this the Christian equivalent speaking today, or something on a higher path?
Well, I mean, that's what remains to be seen. Is Bush said we're going to use force. He says we're going to light a fire. He also said we're going to use peaceful methods. And, of course, all this rhetoric aside, you've got to put the seeming carte blanche for ambitious action that Bush introduced today next to, for example, the article in the New Yorker magazine just earlier this week about plans that apparently are already unfolding for substantial military action against Iran. So it's possible that we're seeing it, the Bush Doctrine Part 2 play out already. And again, I think what will surprise a lot of Republicans, including a lot of the ones, you know, across the river parting away, is that Bush, in his inaugural address that I could see, barely mentioned domestic policy.
Just a little. Not too much.
One line about education, and then about 100 lines about the transformation of the world.
The planet. Mark is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
Well, thanks.
Yeah, I think George Bush is very scary, and I think that this democracy at the end of a barrel of a gun is, you know, the unilateralism, the double standard in the way we negotiate with Saudi Arabia. You know, the world is a far more complicated place than I think George Bush is able to comprehend.
But he said today it needn't be by force of arms. He did not, certainly explicitly, did not exempt Saudi Arabia from his attack on tyranny today.
Well, you know, I'll just make a couple comments. I think dressing this all up with lofty statements about the inherent rights of people to be free is really scary. And, you know, the scariness of his simplicity and lack of understanding of the world is only surpassed by his arrogance. I mean, the unilateralism, the so hell-bent on that war, on that timing. And just one brief comment about the woman who spoke about Nazism. We stopped a madman from trying to rule the world. And, you know, I mean, that was obvious. So many women and children have died in Iraq. I mean, we've killed so many people there, not to mention the 1,000-plus Americans. I find George Bush really scary, and the religious references don't fly for me in the least. I think he's a dangerous man. And
so wherever it comes from, you're not on board, and we hear it. Mark, thanks for calling in from Buffalo. Joined now from Washington by Maura Reynolds. She's White House reporter, or has been for the Los Angeles Times during Bush's first term, now covering Congress. Maura, thanks for joining us tonight.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
Very high-blown language today. Now you've been with President Bush. Now you're moving over to Congress. How do you see this kind of message playing out in the Congress? Is there a majority that's ready to get on board with this kind of crusade? I use the word advisedly to stamp out tyranny in the world. Does he have a Republican backing for that kind of agenda?
I'm not sure he does, but I also think that it's important not to read too much into this speech immediately. I think a lot of people were, amid all the pomp and circumstance, when they stopped to contemplate what the president said, were scratching their heads trying to figure out, okay, what does this actually mean in practice? An inaugural address is really designed to be a statement of principle, to be a statement of sweeping vision. It's not a practical policy address. And so it really remains to be seen exactly how he intends to accomplish this.
But you spent a lot of time with George Bush and watching him. He's developed the reputation for someone who does what he says he'll do. So yes. Here he said, we're going to go after tyranny globally. You buy it or not?
Well, like I said, I mean, I think we have to wait and see what he means. It's definitely a much stronger iteration and a heightening of rhetoric beyond what he's ever said before. His language was extremely broad. I mean, I know you've read the speech, but to talk about the expansion of freedom in all the world, you know, ending tyranny in our world. I mean, in the past, his language has very much been that focused sort of more on the role of tyranny in the Middle East as being a danger to the United States, or that, tyranny and oppression causing dangers to the United States. Here he's just simply saying he's going beyond whether or not any of this threatens us, whether or not this is the root of terrorism. He didn't even mention terrorism in this speech. It's simply that this is, we have to use this religious language advisedly, sort of a messianic vision of what America should be in the world. I wanted to actually, your callers, when I was listening a moment ago, mentioned some of the biblical and religious language in this. I actually spent some time trying to track down some of these references, and I can explain some of them to you if you're interested.
Make it quick, Maura. We've just got a minute and a half here.
Well, I mean, just simply there's a lot of references to hymns, not specifically biblical verses, but to hymns like Yesterday, Today, and Forever, and My Country, Tis of Thee, when he talks about the author of liberty, that comes from that hymn.
So the speechwriter has reached into the sort of liturgical and hymnal music. Wayne Slater, we've just got a minute left here. Maura Reynolds puts it there, in one sense, we're a long way from Midland, Texas. In another, with a speech that's partly, sampled from Christian hymns, we're not.
Absolutely right. I was struck by one thing, and that is that in April 1999, right here in Austin, Texas, George Bush, the governor of Texas, not yet a formal candidate for president, made a speech. And in that speech, it was a tribute to veterans here at the state cemetery. He spoke in the most high-blown religious rhetoric that I had ever heard. And in it, he said, we face new threats that are replacing old enemies, unstable dictators that seek weapons of mass destruction, regional power grabs become global crises. But it is still America that preserves the peace. Our nation still determines the future of freedom. That was George Bush in 1999 as governor. The speechwriter of that speech, first speech he ever wrote for George Bush, was Mike Gerson. That's the guy who wrote the speech today.
Well, and the power is still flowing out of that generator. We'll spend the next 4 years figuring out exactly what's in there. Wayne Slater with the Dallas Morning News. Wonderful to have you tonight from Austin, Texas. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Maura Reynolds with the Los Angeles Times. Good luck covering Congress, and thanks for joining us tonight.
Always a pleasure.
And James Pinkerton, columnist for Newsday, regular contributor to the Fox News Channel. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.